Is this mic active? It seems to be. Yeah, a late-ish one. After midnight, anyway. Yeah. My phone says 02. I'll wait till Franz gets back. Good morning, everybody. We're not quite ready to start. You don't have to take everything down. There's just a small delay for operational reasons. We haven't got everybody in the support team in the room yet. We're missing our Jabber monitor, and our scribe has gone to look for him, so we can't start until they get back. Okay, I think we can start with the administrative part of the meeting before the Jabber monitor gets here. You're very welcome to the ENAM working group session of RIPE 56. And if you thought you were going to be in a different working group, then you probably need to be in a different room. My name is Neil O'Reilly. I'm one of the co-chairs of this working group. And my colleague Karsten Schiefner is over here and might wave or stand up. And you've gotten in your registration pack green sheets with the then version of the draft agenda. And that's been updated a little bit since. And on the mailing list and on Rosie, you'll find the one that's now here on the display screen. And I have to say a few words. I've already welcomed you, but for the ones who missed that bit, you're very welcome, Jim, and anybody else who came in a few minutes after the welcome. Franz Schwarzinger is our scribe. Our Jabber monitor is on its way. We have not microphone stands for people asking questions, ultimately. Oh, we have a jabber monitor hiding in the back of the hall rather than up at the front. Much better place for a jabber monitor, much more discreet. We don't have stand mics, we have hand mics. If people want to ask questions, please identify yourself. If your affiliation is relevant to your question, please disclose it, but you don't have to. Somebody's reminding me that you should all turn your phones off, or at least to silent, just as I'm doing now. And that's all the sort of minor practical arrangements. The next thing we have to do is to confirm that the agenda that you see on the screen is the agenda that we're going to use for the meeting. So if there are things that you think need to be there that haven't been included, now is a good time to say so. We'll be skating very quickly through the minutes of the last meeting and the review of the action list because there's not a lot to say. Then we have three main presentations on a crawler tool from Alexander Meyerhofer from Vienna. We'll have a presentation on the now in production Dutch country code plus 31. And also on the UK country code, which is hopefully going into production in a short number of months. After that, we'll have two items on Enum operations, a report from the RIPE NCC, which, as you know, runs the Tier 0 Enum registry, and some stimulating suggestions from Karsten on performance and availability of Tier 1 name servers. If we've still time, we'll have some short news. And then finally, we'll cover interaction with other working groups and any other business. Is there anything that you note that needs also to be discussed? No hands, good. You also notice that item G on the green sheet doesn't arise because we didn't have any Enum-related plenary sessions this time around. So moving quickly on, the next thing is the action list. All of the actions have been closed since the previous meeting. They were mainly, by very bad planning, things for Karsten and me to do. We try and share out the action list a little more. What am I missing? Never mind, you can see it well enough, even if I don't go full screen. As you know, we're sharing the time slot with the address policy working group, and this was something that we were asked if we were happy with a couple of meetings back, and I was to get back to the other working group chairs, and I did. Karsten and I corrected some typos in the minutes of 55, and in the minutes of 54, and Alex offered at coming up to 55 to give the presentation that I'm about to ask him to give, but we didn't have time at 55, so he's kindly come to 56 instead. And the minutes of the last Enum working group session have already been blessed on the mailing list, so there's no need to discuss them further now. And that done, I'll move back to the agenda, and we'll start with the main presentations. And the first of these is from Alexander Meyerhofer, and it should be the one that pops into view now. Alex, it's yours.
Thank you, Neil. Good morning, everybody. My name is Alexander Meyerhofer. I work for enum.at, which is the Austrian Enum registry for plus 43. What I'm going to talk about today is actually a website and the service behind it, whose name is crawler.enum.at. You can take a look at it right now, but please don't overload it. What is that Enum crawler thing about? If you have seen it already, you might know what it's about. The idea behind it is to explore the e164.arpa namespace and find all numbers with NAPTA records that are out there. The reason why I started this was because one of the most frequently asked questions that we encountered was, okay, how many people can I actually reach using that Enum thingy right now? And I thought that was a good question, and let's find out. And also, it's always fun to play around with large databases with PostgreSQL, so that gave me an opportunity as well. So how does it look like? This is a screenshot from, I think, 3 days ago, something like this. So it's a very simple website where you can see the number of countries where the number space contains enum domain names and some statistics about those countries, recently discovered numbers and stuff like that. So as you can see from that, my crawler has found 22 countries right now with enum delegations where there are actually numbers in there. If you see yourself on the list, very good. If you don't, add a couple of enum domains to your delegation. So how does it work? I mean, if you look at the e164.arpa namespace or any namespace that uses enum-like technology, it should be reasonably easy to crawl because the labels are predictable. It's simply all numbers from 0 to 9. You have a certain number length up to 15 digits. Still, it's a rather large namespace. It's 10 to the power of 15. So it's about 200,000 times larger than the IP version 4 address space. Lucky enough, it's quite a bit smaller than the IPv6 namespace.
Can you say that number?
maybe a drive 57. So there's one property of DNS which comes to the rescue of nailing down the namespace to the namespace that is actually filled with numbers, which is the non-empty terminals. The original idea was stolen from Peter Koch, who told me that idea once. There's actually an RFC about this, 4592, which mandates a server to return no error if there is something below an empty label. So the old behavior, especially in bind, was to return NX domain. The new behavior, so to say, or the clarified behavior, is to return no error, which means you can distinguish a domain name where there are labels below from a domain name which is empty. I have an example here. So if you look at the zone or the snippet of the zone on top and the queries below, if you query for 1234, of course you get no error and records. Same for 333, no error and records. If you query for 777, you get an X domain. If you query for 234, where there is a label below, namely 1234, you get back from the name server no error and empty. So the answer section doesn't contain any answers, but the response code is no error. So that's an indication that there's something below. Same, for example, for 525, because there is still in the fourth record in the zone, there's still a label below. So you get no error, and that's an indication that there's something below. And on the other hand, if you then query for 7.525, you get NX domain, which means that you have reached the end of the tree here. I've done a graphical example. It's the only slide that uses animations, I promise. So if, for example, we start at 4.e164.arpa and I do a DNS query, I get back from the name server no error, which means that there is something below. So what I do in the crawler is I queue the 10 numbers below it for crawling, and then I go through those numbers from 0 to 9, and for 9 of those numbers in that example, I get back no error, there's something below. And for one of the numbers, namely that the enum domain corresponding to the country code 4.5, I get back an X domain, which means to me the tree under that number is empty. There is nothing there anymore. And the crawler continues then. For example, on the second level, I get 90 numbers in that case, and so on and so forth, until it actually gets back no error and records. In that case, I store the records in the database, and still I need to look whether there is something below, because there could still be more numbers below. So that's actually the algorithm behind it. There are a couple of issues with this approach. Some name servers still return an X domain for empty NOM terminals. That was clarified in the RFC I mentioned before. What that means is that the enum space below such a domain name is not being discovered, because an X domain means stop here. And also the crawler deletes existing information below that. For example, if you remove an enum delegation, the name server then returns an X domain, which means that everything below must be deleted in the database. Some older bind versions, I don't know the exact version since that behavior changed, and some PowerDNS versions especially, you have that behavior. The bad thing about this is that when I ran the crawler for the first time, one of the name servers for Evo and 64.ARPA was a name server with such behavior, which led to a temporary loss of the whole 4.e164.arpa domain name in the crawler, of course, not in the DNS. So there is a safeguard now in the program: never delete anything which would delete more than 1,000 nodes. So that's some kind of safeguard against such an error. That is now fixed. On all name servers for e164.arpa properly return no error for empty non-terminals. So what does the crawler actually store for a number? I have number status. You can see from the list. The most interesting thing is that, of course, N, which is NAPTER, and W, there is a wildcard in it. I try to discover wildcards by issuing a second query with underscore label in front of the number. So if I get back something for that and it's the same as for the number itself, I assume it's a wildcard. Of course, I save in the database whether it's there's a problem with a number, and something that I call creative number spaces. There are some number spaces in enum, actually in our country code, where there are dynamically generated zones. They return the same set of NAPTERs for all numbers, so you would have some kind of an infinite loop. I do store in the database the full NAPTER records, the query time, and last time the number was queried, but plus the time when the number was discovered. Some fun results, of course, you can go to the website and browse through it for yourself. We have about 600,000 numbers with about 700,000 NAPTER records in total. Out of those numbers, there are about 20,000 wildcard numbers. So that's an interesting number. There are 22 countries, as I said before. The topmost country is Romania, mainly because there is a service provider who entered enum records for 400,000 numbers. That's his own number block. And on the second place, so to say, is UK with 51,001 numbers. And closely behind, or reasonably behind, is Austria with 32,000 numbers. Some other interesting things: the shortest number with a NAPTER is a number in Romania. It's plus 4778. I don't think it's a full E164 number, but anyway, there are lots of numbers with 15 digits where the crawler actually stops because E164 says numbers should be at maximum 15 digits. And fun enough, the average number for the average number length for normal numbers with an NAPTER record is a little bit above 11 digits. And the average number length for wildcarded numbers is even higher, which is interesting, because I thought that wildcarded numbers would probably be shorter because they cover a larger number space. Popular enum services, interesting enough. The old RFC 2916 style enum service notation is still very popular. That's actually mainly because there is one service provider out there in Romania who uses that notation. Of course, the most popular is SIP, then TEL. Then you have a couple of very popular unregistered enum services, E2U plus EP, that contains some kind of hash. I don't know what it's about. It looks like some kind of encrypted information or something like that. And a couple of other enum services. So that's pretty interesting. Rare enum services. There are a lot of enum services which appear just once, and some of them appear a couple of times, but they don't really have widespread use. Some other observations: the average query time, so the time for the name server to return a response, is 86 milliseconds overall for empty lame delegations, numbers with problems, and so on and so forth, and about 65 milliseconds for numbers with NAPTA records, which is measured from a server in Austria. So China is obviously a lot slower than Germany, for example. There is exactly one NAPTA record with a SIP S URI, and my colleague Otmar Lendl is to blame for that. It was a test record, he told me. Nearly all NAPTA records use the Rufzeichen, sorry. As thank you, as regular expression delimiter. There are some creative delimiters out there. There are a few NAPTAs using spaces as delimiter in the NAPTA records, and there are a couple of them using plus and s and whatever. The most interesting observation probably is 16 of the top 20 enum countries have the color red in their flag. Well. So, software and hardware behind this, short overview, it's a Stone Age dual CPU server, nothing very interesting about that. This runs Debian Linux. The database software is PostgreSQL. There are about 8 million rows in the database right now for each number and for the 10 numbers below each number. And some queries on those 8 million rows are challenging, and it's very interesting sometimes. So that's the reason why some of those numbers I mentioned before are not displayed on the web page, because the query simply takes 10 minutes or something like that. The crawler and the web frontend is written in PHP. I'm using the NetDNS module, which is very similar to the well-known Perl NetDNS module, a CSS framework for the fancy web design, and cute icons and a smarty template engine that's just to create the web page. It took me about, I would say, 2 weeks for the initial version to come up with that, and then about 4 or 5 days to create the second better version of that. So that's about the time span that it took me. And probably interesting, it takes about 3 weeks currently to do a full run through the whole number space. So if you put some numbers in there, Gesundheit, then you have to wait about 3 weeks until the numbers show up in the crawler. Well, that's it. Thank you very much. I hope I'm in time. I think so.
Definitely.
Any questions?
Immaculate.
Yes, Ed.
About the wildcard numbers being longer.
Ed Lewis from Newstar. From about your comment about wildcards being longer than the fully. One thing you might be running into is people have been putting wildcards in front of a fully qualified number for over-dialing.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I have investigated that a little bit, and one of the reasons is that one of the service providers in Austria is using simply wildcards for normal numbers. Even he has not any extensions behind that number. So it's very easy for a single provider to have changed the statistics significantly.
I have a question too. Carsten Schiefner. And I wonder a little bit about the UK figures. Maybe you can explain a little bit about that, or Danish later on. Is that because of crew, the carrier registration and user, you know? Is that the 55,000, is that the figure, or the reason for the figure?
I think the number is 51,001. I suppose it's 51,000 from crew, and the other one is Jim's number. Yeah, I think it's because of crew. Yeah,
okay.
Because there are like number ranges. You can browse through the number range where all 10,000 numbers within the number block have an adapter.
Oh,
so
okay.
That seems like because of crew usage. Yeah.
Thank you.
Da, 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 da. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions? If you have any ideas about what you would like to have be. What you would like to see on the web page being displayed for a number, let me know. I'm open for suggestions, and it's intended as some kind of monitoring service for the user enum community.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you.
That's, I think, very impressive, and I'm sure everybody was fascinated by it. It's a moment to show our appreciation to Alex. Ask Antoine Verschuren to tell us about how things are going in the Netherlands. I think if you just press the escape key.
Yeah. It's over there. Okay. Good morning, everybody. An update on what happened to Enum in the Netherlands. Last time I gave an update on Enum in the Netherlands was, I think, 3 RIPEs ago. So let's start where we left off there. In the Netherlands, we had this is a short history of what happened before. We had a report back in 2001 about if we were going to deploy Enum in the Netherlands, what were the conditions that it should follow. Shortly after that, we had a protective delegation of the Dutch Enum zone to our ministry. And then came a period where there was hardly any interest from the market to start a trial, which was something that was suggested in the report. But then in 2005, we got a VoIP boom in the Netherlands. A lot of cable operators started to offer VoIP services. And there was a sudden interest in Enum. And because the NLEC report said that, the first thing we need is a registry, we as IDN, which was the registry for that, and I'll started the Enum initiative, and this is basically where I left you all a few right meetings ago. So some special market observations for the Netherlands. It is quite an innovative market. There is a high broadband penetration, one of the highest in the world, I guess. Also, there is a lot of VoIP in the Netherlands. I know the number from October last year, which was 28% of all voice in the Netherlands was VoIP. So quite a high uptake there. I believe it's a lot higher already. We have a government that promotes competition, so they also have a policy doing that. Our regulator, and that is something that is a bit different from other countries, they supply number blocks directly to end users, so not only to operators. So if I'm a large company and I want to have a number block, I can go directly to the regulator and say, hey, give me that block, and I then have to go to a telco to be able to deliver that on the PSTN. And another thing is that operators in the Netherlands already have a center number portability database, which is called COIN, and that's a number portability database for all the numbers. So not only for the mobile or for the landlines, it's a central number portability database, and every operator in the Netherlands is using that. Where we left off, we started an initiative, and we needed to get support for that. We got some explicit support from BTG, which is an interest group for large telco users in the Netherlands, most of them with their own number. So think of companies like Philips, Shells. Those are the companies which are in this interest group. We had specific support from ISOCanel, from RIPE-NCC, from NLNet Labs. And there were no constructive objections from cable operators because they already started their own voice VoIP peering. And the telcos couldn't formulate a joint position. So we had to find a way for them to give input to the process, but they were not in a position to get a joint position saying, okay, this is what you should do or shouldn't do. Thank you, Carsten. So, what we did then was we had to get a sort of like a stick to get this moving. So we did. We requested a redelegation of the Dutch ENMZO, which was actually the first redelegation done by RIPE, and there was no process between the ITU and RIPE. So we had to sort of like invent that ourselves. And then the ministry had 6 weeks to sort of like consult the market for objections of the redelegation, which sort of like was the stick to get things moving. There were some consultation results. It needed to be an open and transparent policy. That was one of the results of the NLEC report we had to follow. That's basically it. There should be a compulsory market consultation about policy and technical requirements. That was something that we agreed to. It should only be about public user enum, so no infrastructure enum was involved. And there were also some you know, requests from the consultation that our government said, well, okay, we don't follow this because it conflicts with the NLEC report or it conflicts with our own policy. One of the things is, for example, that operators wanted the fact that only operators could do registrations. So that was sort of like a closed market, and our government didn't agree with that. So those were sort of like the things we needed to do. We have a convenant between the ministry and the newly formed organization, ENMNL, for these conditions. We had to do a market consultation. So in June 2007, we started an ENM innovation platform where we consulted the market, and we got that report back on 26th of March this year, and that was also the date that we did our first ENM registration, which was more like a ceremony where we gave our Director General of the regulator the first ENM registration. So what were the results of this innovation platform? Well, there should be strong validation agent requirements. That was quite clear. They wanted this to be very tightly regulated in terms of who owns a number and who can register it. That gave us the chance to have an open registrar market. There should be a low threshold to become a registrar so that you have a lot of competition in that market to start offering services or invent services. There should be a clear complaint procedure. That was a requirement from mostly the operators, which, if a number got registered wrong, then it should be an easy complaint procedure to get the number out of the ENM zone. You can only register numbers through a registrar, so it's a registrant setup. Almost all numbers can be registered. There are very few exceptions. There were also use cases, for example, for premium numbers. Examples were given that, when you look at the TV during the night, I don't know what they show in your country, but we will usually have these erotic advertisements with numbers to dial where you have to pay a high fee. And the things that strike me always is that next to the number, they also have a website. So ENM could possibly have something there for premium numbers. We do pre-delegation DNS checks. We use a validation token between the validation agent and the registry. Validation methods will be invented by the market, but they will be sort of like approved by the registry. We allow number block registrations, and we in the beginning we will have no regular Whois service because, you know, it's not the registration that determines who owns a number. And we will do DNSSEC and IPv6 within 1 year after the introduction. And actually, we already have the IPv6, so that's something that we already do. And DNSSEC will probably be there beginning of 2009. Some market observations after that. We already expected interest from these large telco users organization with their own number blocks. But the signals we're getting now is that they're really interested and are ready to register large blocks and so a lot of numbers, more than we anticipated for in the beginning. To give an estimate, we expected, you know, first year perhaps we have 5,000 registrations, but they already ask us things like, you know, can you do 100,000 registrations in a month? Which is actually quite high. Regular ISPs are hesitating. They don't have a service to offer for Enum, so they sort of like are waiting for that to happen. Telco operators are interested, but it takes them, because they're a massive organization, it takes them a long time to get this innovative idea running, so they will probably outsource validation to parties, to a third party, trusted third parties. And this is one of the most important observations, and that is there is surprisingly much interest from banks and online traders and stock market traders and those sorts of organizations to use Enum as a sort of like a distribution channel for public keys, for identity management. So what they basically do is, you know, or want to do, is you publish a public key somewhere and you need a single identifier to get to that key of a person. And, well, Enum is a way that every user, I mean, most of the users above a certain age, all have a mobile number. And why not use that as an identifier, because it's a globally unique distribution channel. And we're working with them to sort of like see where this is going to. Short about the registry, separate foundation, procedures and documentation and stuff like that takes more time than we anticipated. We start with a limited number of known registrars because we have a temporary registry system to get things going. We will use the same registry software as Enum-AT and IENUM in a few months when we finish building that and get all the documentation up and stuff like that. The next step is just go for, you know, any registrar can enter. We will have DNSSEC and IPv6 in 2009. I already said that DNSSEC, especially a requirement for those banks and online traders which want to have these secure delegations. Something about pricing. This is more marketing, but it gives you an impression of what we're about to do. So where are we now? 10 registrars have started. That means that we have 10 registrars. As a basic interface online, we have started the implementation of the real registry system. First validation agents have started. We have the first validation method approved, and we have two nurturing projects. One of them is with these banks and online traders, and another one is basically some security in general. And the result will be evaluated by the end of 2009, which is something that we're obligated to do according to our convenant with the ministry. And if you have any questions, these are the addresses you can look for all of this. Any questions?
Small amount of time to take a question now, one or two. Karsten is minding the clock. Questions?
Yeah, you made me hurry.
Then thank you very much, Antoine. we move to the next presentation, which is from Dinesh Babuta, already, from Plus 44 Land, which, as you know, is the United Kingdom.
It's Windows, I don't know how to use this. The wrong name.
Oh, yours is a PDF. Yours is a PDF.
Mine's a PDF, yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
This one?
Thanks. Okay. To move forward.
Sorry?
That to move forward. Okay. Hi. Just a quick, very, very quick update on what's happening in the UK. There's been some changes recently, which I'll go through, and we're hoping to... Sorry.
You're missing the mic.
I'm missing the mic. Is that better? Okay. I think next time we'll have to sell more tickets and be in a bigger room. So just a quick update. Recap. It's... No, it's me being very nervous, I think. There you go. Well, at least I bring some fun into this. Just a quick recap. UK Enum Consortium was formed in October 2006 as a not-for-profit limited by guarantee organisation. There were four interim directors, our own very own Jim Reid, who's sitting right there, Nigel Titley, Adrian Snell, and John Souter from Lynx. They took the company to where it was until the AGM that was held last month. It's basically, the UKEC is recognized as the oversight governance body for Enum within the UK. We are the people who talk about Enum. We are the people who know about Enum. And so, in a sense, we're like a regulator, although we're not statutory. Because we're recognized by the Department of Business Enterprise and Regulatory Reform, who were previously known as DTI, that's why I use a small R there, just to show how important UKEC is within the governance structure. Late last year, the Tier 1 registry was appointed, and that's nominate. So what's happened recently is that we've decided on a member-based model, one member, one vote, keep it plain and simple. However, the membership fees, because we're like a trade organization, the membership fees actually depends on your turnover. So we're looking at membership fees of £1,000 a year, £5,000 a year, and £10,000 a year. And really, it doesn't matter how much you pay, you still get one vote. You know, keep it simple. To entice people to become members and become part of the policy process, what we have said is that within the first year, you get a discount, so up to 50%. So if anyone wants to join us, please do so. We had the AGM. Actually, the 25th of March was important for us as well as the NL registry, who had their first registration. We had our AGM, and ironically, none of the interim directors got re-elected, but we have four initial directors. I'm one of them. The others are Peter Gradwell, you may have heard of him, Steve Kennedy, and James Blessing, who frequents these parts sometimes. And we had 12 members who signed up for membership and were able to vote us in, so thank you very much for that. So what's happening now is that fitting in, let's put it that way. Things are taking time. There's a lot of work that was done by the interim directors, and we're just basically having a knowledge dump by them. So there's a lot of transfer of responsibilities and knowledge, doing all the company documentation, all the legal stuff, as well as the four directors. As well as the four directors on the board, we just appointed a representative from Nominate, Jay Daly, to be on the board, and we're also looking for an independent chairman. An interim secretariat was appointed. This is just to get things up and running, and a tender process will be going out, and started the outreach with this meeting, basically. What else needs to be done? The governance framework needs to be completed. The policy advisory committee needs to be formed, who will basically advise us. All that they do is have an advisory role. Whether we listen to them or not is a different matter, but I guess a lot of the times they'll come up with good policies. We need to create the dispute resolution process. Basically, if there are any disputes with numbers, like a number that's been registered incorrectly, then we have to come up with a resolution, dispute resolution process, and go through that. The other thing that we need to do is come up with a code of conduct for registrars. Also, what's happening is that we're forming a joint review committee, two of the directors from UKEC and two members from Nominate, the Tier 1 registry, are going to sit on this and go through the various consultations. The registrar contract needs to be ratified, so does the EPP interface and the accreditation requirements. What still remains to be done is the 4-4 delegation. That needs to move from Jim over to us, and then we can delegate the name servers over to Nominate. One of the issues is enticing the VoIP providers, existing VoIP providers who have tons and tons of numbers, to bring their existing numbers into the enum tree. That seems to be a bit hard at the moment, but we're working on that. And then the next stage is that Nominate are going to launch registrations in summer of this year. From what I gather, the registration prices are going to be around £5 for the first one per year, and then ten pence for each and every one in a contiguous block. So, any questions?
Wow, I guess the lack of questions indicates how clear the presentation was. I'd like to make one little comment. I love the logo. Yeah. It's reminiscent of the Steam phone.
Thanks to Adrian Snell for that. Any questions? No? Okay, well, there'll be a much better update in Dubai, so see you then.
Good. Plug for the next meeting. And I think next up is Anand Budev to give the update from the Tier 0 registry, which is run by the RIPE NCC. We might have to refind his slides.
Let's take a look. Yeah. Okay. Now we have privacy.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Anand Buddhadev. I'm the DNS Services Manager at the RIPE NCC, and I'm here to do a little presentation telling you what's been happening in the enum operations since RIPE 55. A little bit of history for people who might be new to this working group. The RIPE NCC has been operating the enum zone since 2002. We have the master server in Amsterdam, nspry.ripe.net, and we have 5 secondaries elsewhere in the world. Provisioning for this zone is done in the same way as the rest of our provisioning for reverse DNS, and that's through the RIPE database. A list of changes since RIPE 55. In January 2008, Tanzania plus 255 was added to the zone. In February, we added Slovenia plus 386. And also in February, plus 1 for the USA was removed. At the moment, we have 45 delegations in the zone. (Clears throat) So one of the significant changes since RIPE 55 was the introduction of DNSSEC into this zone. In July last year, the NCC made a proposal to the IAB about its intention to sign the zone, and the IAB accepted this proposal and informed the ITU. And in 2007, August, they approved this proposal. And in September, the NCC made up a plan and announced this to the DNS and ENAM working groups. On the 26th of November, this zone was actually signed. And finally, on the 25th of March, very important date, it seems, the NCC actually began accepting secure delegations in this zone. So, timeline there. Some information about getting secure delegations. We have a key signing key published at that URL. If you want to request a secure delegation, you have to do that by updating the enum object in the RIPE database and introduce the DSR data attribute. And some notes about this are available also on the RIPE NCC website. The current status, we have two signed zones, that's +48 for Poland and +420 for the Czech Republic. And since last week, we have one secure delegation from +48. The other significant development since RIPE 55 has been the introduction of DNS monitoring for the ENAM zone. There was a proposal by Andre Suri, I hope I pronounced that right, at RIPE 55 to allow for DNS mon to monitor the tier one ENAM zones. And there was a lot of discussion on the mailing list, on the ENAM mailing list and the NCC working group mailing list. And eventually that led to the publication of RIPE document 429 on 17th April. And tier one ENAM operators may now request for the monitoring of their zones in DNSMon. This is a paid service, so there's a charge for it. And please talk to our IS people, Mark Runs, if you have any questions about this. That's it. Any questions from anybody?
Maybe the after-breakfast slot inhibits people too much from asking questions. Peter Koch is standing up and wants to make some observation.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan, for this interesting update. And of course, you know what's coming. I'm going to ask you some questions about the DNSSEC stuff. Have you been able to actually monitor the amount of DNS queries that are actually soliciting DNSSEC responses? Has there been any change to that? I mean, you gave a presentation, or Andre gave a presentation at a previous RIPE meetings about that, but have there been changes?
No, we haven't actually looked to see if there have been any significant changes. And as I've mentioned, we've only got the one secure delegation now since last week, so it's all very fresh at the moment. I can certainly provide some more statistics at the next RIPE meeting. I think we'll have something to show at that time, but at the moment, no.
Okay, thanks. And I forgot to set my name, Peter Koch, sorry.
Okay. Hello, my name is Andrzej Suri.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Well. Just quick update, we also did secure delegation of Czech ENAM zone, and we did day before the Polish. We were first.
Thank you for that. I wasn't aware. I only heard from the Polish people, and I quickly checked at that time.
I didn't let you know. So my fault.
All right, so that's good news. We now have two secure delegations. Thanks, Andre.
And a side effect of Anand's presentation is that we've also covered item X on the agenda, so we won't need to visit that afterwards. And that's the moving through of the DNS-MON, broadening of the DNS-MON criteria through the NCC Services Working Group. No more questions, then I'll ask the next speaker to step forward. It's Carsten Schiefner, our co-chair, who's going to talk about performance and availability of Tier 1, I think.
It was open already. That's the Tier 1, this one here.
This one? This one?
The second one, yeah. Excellent. Good morning, everybody. My name is Carsten Schiefner. This is a very short presentation about the Tier 1 performance and availability. Most of the time, I hope so, will be consumed by a lively discussion about it. The status quo is, as we heard it from Anand's presentation already, is that the RapNCC's DNS MON service is also now available to Tier 1 enum registries on an opt-in basis, as the Tier 1 registries could come and should come to the RapNCC to get their DNS service for their respective enum delegation country, enum country code delegation, to get that monitored. The question is, shall we as a Enum working group, or as the Enum working group, shall we leave it at this stage, or shall we try to take it further? And if the latter, what is further and how? Any potential measures in this regard always had and still have political implications, possibly unwanted side effects in the political space, say on layer 9. On the other hand, this also is an operational issue with technical implications as well, and definitely unwanted side effects. To spark off a discussion, I digged out an email from John Clanson from this January about a discussion we had, or that was a discussion on the email on the Enum working group mailing list, actually, about how to deal with lame or non-performing delegations whatsoever. I've put that up here. I can also read it out. And this email is just meant to spark off the discussion. What to do here, if anything, is entirely up to this group, RIPE-NCC and the IAB, although if it involves asking ATUT to adopt any procedures that are not now in place, I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for them to agree, nor would I predict that they would agree to whatever was asked of them without putting their stamp on it. I would give the following advice if anyone asked me. It is fine to encourage RIPE-NCC to make periodic checks of server configuration accessibility. If the results of those checks are not satisfactory, the delegated party should be notified and asked to fix things. If the delegated party does not respond, it would be fine for RIPE-NCC to notify the entity that requested and or signed off on the delegation and make sure they are aware of the problem and its implications to accessibility and usability of the domain they are requested. We have that contact information. Using it doesn't need to involve the ITU. So this is not what I have in mind as a way forward. This is, as I said, and as the title of the slide also tells you, this is just meant to spark off a discussion. And the very last sentence on it, which was which came from Curtis yesterday on V6, but Neil and I both felt that it's very much applicable to Enum in that situation as well. The responsible team may think they are working in a laboratory environment, but other people are actually trying to run a service on top of it. So this is basically the problem space, and we should be discussing here in the working group. And having said so, the floor is yours. Just to come up, the basic question is, from my point of view, shall we leave it at this stage, or shall we try to take it further?
First question is, you were introduced as a working group chair, co-chair. Is this action on you as a person, or is this action on you as a working group co-chair, just for clarity?
That's a good one, actually. I would like to take it as an action on me as a person, first of all, as an interested member of the Yeenum community.
Thank you. That makes things clear. And now I forgot what I wanted to say for the second time, so Jim, go first.
Thank you. Jim Reed, just some random punter in the street. I was the one that particularly raised this concern about the potential political implications of monitoring things without consent of the delegation holder. I think the way that we might be able to sort of finesse this issue a little about it is talk about it or communicate this to ITUT, but purely present it as an operational matter. And we might say, for example, is that for operational reasons, security and stability of the tier zero delegation, blah, 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 RIPE NCC chooses to monitor its delegations just to check the health of things. Absolutely fine, that's what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Any professional organization would want to do that. We say that as a side effect of that, we would be in a position to inform the delegation holder if there was a failure in their delegation, would you like us to do that? I think that might be some way to get around this a little bit, but doing anything more than monitoring and having some kind of formally acknowledged or understood mechanism for that could be destabilizing in a political sense. I think it'd be most inappropriate for the NCC to go around and start saying to a delegation holder, you've got a lame name server, please fix it, or I pulled your delegation because you've had a lame delegation and it's created far too much traffic on the tier ones or the tier zero infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Have a nice day. I don't think it should do either of those two things, but I think it's something that's a little bit more couched in purely operational factors. It's nothing to do with anything that might be touch on issues of national sovereignty or any of other these layer nine problems. Then there's much more chance of success. And maybe we just present this as a statement of fact to the ITUT,
mm-hmm.
just as the NCC did when they actually signed the zone. This is purely an operational thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just do it.
So would you suggest something like a best practice document or an informal recommendation or something?
No, I don't think it needs to go anywhere near as elaborate as that. I would suggest we just send a letter to ITUT or we get this working group, if the working group feels it's the right thing to do, is send a letter on the lines we just said, send that to ITUT, here's what we are doing,
mm-hmm.
we're giving you this information purely to inform your delegates and other members what's going on, and make sure it's put in a way which is not going to start sending alarm bells going off in Geneva,
yep.
or in some of the other people that go along to those meetings.
Okay.
Jim, Neil O'Reilly wearing my chair hat, my co-chair hat, I think that's a very helpful suggestion. And I think you've walked yourself into an action item to work with Karsten and myself to finalize that.
Well, since
document.
I'm no longer on the boards of either UK, CIA or IPNCC, I might have some time to spare.
Olaf.
Olaf Kolkman, this time speaking as member of the IAB. RIPE NCC is not in the business of sending liaisons to the ITUT. The way I see, and now I'm speaking personally more than an IAB member, but the way I see the role of this working group is to provide RIPE NCC advice at its operations, but that I don't think that is leading.
You don't think what?
That is leading.
Mm-hmm.
The Yeenum service is a triangular relation, so to speak, between the ITUT, the IAB, and the RIPE NCC. IAB and the RIPE NCC are working tightly together and will take advice from this working group, but will base decisions onto that. So if this working group comes up with a text, please make sure it passes the RIPE NCC and the IAB before it passes onto the ITUT.
Olaf, Neil again here.
Chain.
I think it would probably be helpful if you had sight of that document before it moves out of this working group.
That would be helpful.
Yes, Anton Schuren, this sounds very well. I mean, I realize that this has political implications, but it probably doesn't solve the whole problem. And so I wonder which path we should follow to really solve the technical problem. I sort of like to compare it to the YouTube hijacking problem, where there is one organization or one country that basically, screws the rest of the world. And what can we do about this? There are a lot of countries which have their zones in operations and otherwise are still in trial, and those in trial don't care about the ones in operations. That's sort of like how it feels to me. Now, what we probably see happen is that people are going to hard code in their software that these countries are not to be queried because it breaks things, and it will be a very bad thing, or a very bad thing, and it will be very difficult to get it out of this software. And is there perhaps another way? I don't have the solution here. I don't have a very strong opinion about it. Should we sort of like only do the administrative registration at RIPE for these countries and do something like a non-delegated administrative registration and only do the delegation when it works? I don't have the answer to that, but I do think that it's probably a very bad idea if people start programming in software to not query certain delegations.
Robert Tschischke from the Austrian Enum Registry. I'd like to pick up on one of the things Antoine said. First of all, let me stress that those non-working delegations are really bad for this very fragile Enum ecosystems. I'm happy to hear that the market might be taking up in the Netherlands, but in most countries, it's really hard work, tough work, to get registrars into the system and to try to build up some confidence on this system. And every lame delegation and every failure really disturbs a kind of trust in the whole stability of the system. So it's really a very operational, not political issue, it's a really operational issue how to deal with it. And the danger of having certain countries put on a kind of, let's call it distributed blocking list, which is really a bad thing, is very real. We have this problem with Italy 3 or 4 times, and I know that certain Austrian registrars as service providers just put it on a block list, they will never ask it again. So that's a situation we should avoid. The other thing is, maybe call me naive, but I don't think that anybody is really trying to intentionally hurt the system. So it's not those kind of hijacking situation. It's more or less that there is no distinct separation between a delegation to a server which is operated under, let's say, industry production environment conditions, and those who consider themselves still in a kind of phase of trial. And maybe it might be a good idea that every hold of a delegation might declare itself whether he considers itself services as a production ready service or something which is still under, just run under best effort and don't rely on it. It may not solve the problem 100%, but given that nobody really intentionally wants to hurt others, might be a way to help a little bit.
Yeah, what you've just said might be even part of the next presentation, as in the registry operator might declare whether it's in production already, or even maybe should declare whether it's in production already or whether it's still in trial mode or whatever else. Yeah. So, but yeah, that's gonna come up during the next presentation.
Paul Jekfeldt from Cisco. I think we have to be very, very, very careful with the words here, and I would like to have a clarification from when people talk about someone not managing the delegation, for example, for Italy, and that destroys for all of us. That destroys the ability of routing calls to Italy. If I make a phone call in Sweden, look up numbers in Sweden, that works. Okay. So this problem of screwing up your own namespace or your delegation is something that is always happening, for example, in the SS7 world all the time. It happens all the time on the internet as well, both for routing and both for DNS. So I would urge people in this room to be a little bit more careful when they're saying that someone else, by screwing up their delegation, destroys the ability, from a technical point of view, the ability to route phone calls like to other domain names or other phone numbers. So I think you made the the last speaker made the more correct statement that what we really talk about here is that the more number, the higher the number of lame delegations we have, the harder it will be to convince people to get trust in the ENUM system, which is something completely different from potential like implications regarding operations.
Thanks, Patrick. Jim Reed. I want to just go back on something that Robert mentioned a few moments ago about the perception that certain ENUM delegations are for trials or for test purposes, whereas others are in some kind of notional production use. Again, we have to be very careful about the language here, just to amplify what Patrick has said. I have had the misfortune to go to Study Group 2 and be there when the interim procedures were there. Now, the interim procedures were set up for trials, mm-hmm. and only trials, and it explicitly says in the ITU document, not for production use. Now, if we turn around and say, some of you guys are only doing this for trial experiments and you're not doing a good enough job of keeping your name server infrastructure right, that's going to create a huge big firestorm, because people are going to say, we were only doing this for trials all along, so how come you're doing it for something else now? Let's be very careful if anything's going to be said about this, that it's put in such a way it's not going to inflame that situation.
Peter Koch, D. Nick. Couple of things. First of all, to Patrick, I tend to agree with you on the point that, someone screwing up country foo does not necessarily screw up ENUM operations in country bar. Except for those cases where someone from country bar is trying to call someone in country foo, which was the screwed up one, and then starts thinking that, oh, this ENUM thing doesn't work. So that's the point. Quite frankly, given the state of deployment of ENUM currently, I'm not sure that these screwed up countries are actually the problem we have. They are a problem, but probably not the the biggest roadblock in here. I also don't think this is about the trial versus production thing, because even if you are in trial mode, and Jim's remarks set aside for a second, there is running a name server that somehow responds authoritatively isn't a big issue. And if you're running in trial mode and the data quality in there is bad, that's something completely different. Mm-hmm. I guess the issues at hand here are not the gap between the 95% and 100% reliability thing. So it's explicitly not about chasing down every lame delegation thing, right? So any best practices and so on and so forth, I guess that's too far a target and we shouldn't bother with that. It's the particular cases where one manages to have a perfectly lame delegation in one way or another. So this is completely unresponsive, and the way the DNS works, it's just, it goes over timeouts and so on and so forth. I wonder whether these cases happen often enough to actually come up with a policy document, a heavyweight proposal, sending letters and troops to the ITU and so on and so forth, but instead have a very close look at these. And it might be reoccurring at particular prefixes, might be a widespread disease, but I guess it can be dealt with on a case-by-case basis very pragmatically.
Mm-hmm. Well, how often is always a matter of a definition, I guess. On the other hand, I guess I can say it happens on a more or less regular basis, and it's on a continuing basis that one or the other delegation just gets lame and stays lame.
Well, again, perfectly lame is the issue at hand here.
Perfectly lame.
And when you say there are reoccurring events, is it repeated offenders or?
Yeah.
Now that can be dealt with one way or another.
Yeah, and that is exactly why we're discussing the issue here. As in, should we come with a more or less generalized idea about it, or is it really as you put it on a case by case basis by more or less private individuals?
Well, my suggestion is that there's no one in the queue behind me, so I just keep talking
to
the mic. Yep. Yeah. Well, anyway, my personal opinion is that.
repeated offenders suggests dealing with this on a case-by-case basis. If it's a widespread disease, there needs to be, probably not needs to, but it might be helpful to have a more general approach. But repeated offenders,
Okay.
Something for the shame and blame, but I didn't say that.
Anybody else? Obviously not. So my oh yeah.
I just want to know which. Does this one work? It is on.
It is on. Batteries are on.
I just want to know what the conclusion is at this moment of the discussion that we had. What is the takeaway of the chairs?
Well, what this chair is taking away from it, Neil O'Reilly, is that we have an action item to produce a draft guidance document for the RIPE NCC about operational problems. And that action item, Jim has agreed he will lead, and we will take care that you, Olaf, see the document at an early draft stage.
But I heard the last speaker suggest, well, don't go into that amount of overhead and treat things on a case-by-case basis. Now, that can be the content of the document, but if that is sort of the direction, the work, the if that is the conclusion of this room, caught by the chairs, as an instruction to the document author, then it would be good to know.
I think that would fit my vision of the conclusion of the room.
Mm-hmm.
Can I have a show of dissent, please? Anybody who doesn't agree with that conclusion should raise their hand.
Could you rephrase that conclusion?
The conclusion is that there will be a document guiding the NCC about how it should cope with operational problems in Enum. It should be a lightweight enough document because we don't need to make a meal of this, but it should be something that will be supportive of the RIPE NCC and coming from this working group. And Patrick has a comment. Try this one, Patrick.
Ola should never be allowed to touch microphones, obviously. You just ordered three microphones today. Okay. It's here, touch me. I think that's good. I think that kind of document is good, but I think you have to be careful on what you word it and what kind of intention you would like to have with the document, because we have to remember what RIPE NCC is doing this as a global service, getting instructions from the IAB.
Right.
Okay. The Enum working group in RIPE is sort of a subset of, we have a subset of the various different kind of services that are happening here, that it's not serving only the RIPE community, this mm-hmm. service. Okay. So I just want this working group, it's pretty easy because Olaf is here, I don't want this working group to start to give instructions to something or do something that makes IAB unhappy.
Clearly that's very much to be avoided, Patrick.
Yep.
And I think something rather surreal is occurring to me, because although we want to make a very lightweight document after Peter's suggestions, the layer 9 and above considerations in this document are actually quite heavy. So it's going to be a top-heavy, lightweight document.
And
I think the people who have the clearest sense of the balance and the sensitivity that needs to be brought to the preparation of this document are all in the room, mm-hmm. and all will have sight of the document at an early stage.
Yeah.
I'm now at the point, if it's going to be so light, why do we need a document? Because any document will have layer 9 implications. And this was me talking on personal title, Olaf Kolkman, personal title.
Yeah, because I think we need to have some document which is a point of record because the repeated offending has been difficult to deal with in the past. And I think we need to do, there's been a simmering irritation in among a number of members of the working group that whatever we do on a case by, whatever we've done each time on a case by case basis hasn't quite done it, and we need to write something down.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Koch, once again, I'd rather like to see this operational problems a bit more qualified, even in the light of the adjective that you say it should be a lightweight document, for two reasons. One is that I guess we can trust the RIPE NCC to deal with the usual operational problems on a day-to-day basis in a very competent manner, as they have shown over the last couple of years. And the other one is that, we're actually not after these single lane delegations. So it's like mm-hmm. severe operational problems or anything like that. So just keeping in mind, keeping a very narrow focus on this. And one design criterion for this is having a lightweight document, but not
Peter.
Start dealing with lame delegations and stuff, because that's making bad implications.
Peter, I guess you just have volunteered yourself to be part of the document writing process and to give input to that. Thank you so much.
Wow. The microphone does not really work.
That gives us action point 56.1. And Jim Reed has kindly agreed to be the leader of the lightweight editorial board for that document. And I think applause from the next room, very, very timely. But I think we've spun this out for today. Is that the case?
I guess so. Oh.
Not really.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I go with Patrick Fellström. I think I just want to clarify a little bit what I just said. I think the only sensitivity that I might see is whether the receiver of this document that we are producing is the IB or IPNCC, for example, or both. And that's something that, as Olav is here, is pretty easy to resolve. Mm-hmm. That is a typical example that might be, have some implications. It might be the case that the document should be sent to the IB and then ask the IB, well, maybe you need to talk to RIPE NCC about this or something. I don't know. We just need to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
We need to think about that a little further. We do that face-to-face and by email, either privately or on the list.
Yep. Which, I guess,
that
finishes
to
that
the next
agenda point.
Item, which is F1 short news.
Mm-hmm. And I just wonder... Is it, yeah?
Hmm?
Enumdata.org update. Maybe it's up already? No? Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a short update on the enumdata.org website, which is the, in quotation marks, official website when it comes to information on Tier 1 delegations. This information is provided by the registries themselves. This is how the website actually looks like. We heard that already. Delegation of plus one, the North American numbering plan is withdrawn since RIPE 55. We heard that from Anand. The delegation of Switzerland plus 41 is, according to rumors I've heard, is likely to be withdrawn soon. It's still in the zone, but it's likely to be withdrawn soon. Here's a couple of, how should I put it, of requests actually from the two co-chairs of this working group. If you are a Tier 1 registry, please check your entry for correctness and send any updates you might have to enum-wg-chair@ripe.net, which is the Mail Explorer or the role account for the two of us. And everybody else, if you feel that the entry for a certain delegation over time has become sort of incorrect or incomplete or needs updating, you may want to contact the respective Tier 1 enum registry to actually have them update their entry on this very website.
And so, as you could see here, the website also specifies whether this data is in production, is in trial, is in hiatus, and so forth, and so forth. So everybody who would have an interest in what's the status of the registry of the Tier 1 Enum delegation actually right now could just hit the website enumdata.org and get information about that. And yeah, again, if he or she feels that the information is not correct any longer, you may want to contact the Enum Tier 1 registry for that. There's also, you could see that underlined as a link, there's a list of standard questions. That brings me to the next point. If you think that the proposed list of standard questions should be modified or extended, please also contact us and send your suggestions to enum-wg-chair@ripe.net so that we have an opportunity to sneak those additional questions into the standard set of questions, which basically, oh, wrong key, brings me to the end of the update on enumdata.org. And yeah, make use out of it in both ways. Keep it up to date. And if you have questions on a particular registry, hit the website and try to find your answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Karsten. And that brings us to item Y of the agenda, any other business? Everybody's keeping the head down. Good. Then we pass to item Z, which is just to remind you of the status of the action items. We had no open action items going into the beginning of the meeting. We have one action item generated from the meeting, and that's to generate this operational document for coping with the problems that we've been having on and off intermittently. And Jim Reed has kindly agreed to lead that effort, and I expect that Karsten and myself, and Patrick and Olaf, will be among the contributors. And I'm not sure whether Robert is looking at me, trying not to nod, or actually nodding, but I'm sure he'll be interested as well. And that brings us, with a minute or two to spare, to the coffee queue. Thank you all for coming. The next meeting, as you know, will be in Dubai. And I look forward to, Karsten and I look forward to seeing most of you there again and to having an interesting agenda for you that time as well. Thank you all for coming. Special thanks to our scribe, our stenographer, our technical support person, our Jabber monitor. Did anything come in on Jabber? No discussion. And Karsten has a last word to say.
And next time we're going to run into your coffee break again, we promise. So.
And thanks to the chairs.
It was our pleasure.
Thanks to all for thanking the chairs.